I am Plot on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. For International Women's Day, we go to the interview I taped last week with the acclaimed and best-selling author Kim Eklund. Her new novel is Speak, Silence. It is a book with the Bosnian War as its backdrop as her characters navigate the fallout of the conflict. Gota is a magazine journalist from Toronto who remembers the intimate year she spent in Paris with Cosmos. Now, with a film festival to be held in Sarajevo she's assigned to cover, she goes hoping to meet Cosmos and to reconnect. In the 11 years since Paris, she has had his daughter, and now as they meet again, he is with Idina, and they're all drawn to each other. I'll get Ms. Eklund to tell us about her book and these characters as part of the world, and the various themes in it, such as war, war crimes, genocide, loss, shame, and strength. Idina is a lawyer and someone who works now to expose sexual violence and fight for justice. She works with women in the community who were abused and raped during the war, and she takes down their stories in the hope of bringing perpetrators to justice. This all takes place just as the International Criminal Court in The Hague is coming into being, and the book sees Gota travel there and hear the harrowing stories that are told as part of prosecuting war crimes. The book is getting great notices and is being lauded for its lyricism, and in one review it's hailed as a necessary book to read. Kim Eklund is the author of novels Elephant Winter, Dagmar's Daughter, Under the Visible Life, and The Disappearance, which was a bestseller and shortlisted for the Giller Prize. This new book is published by Penguin. She joined me from Toronto last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Kim Eklund. Ms. Eklund, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Were you a natural storyteller, say, even as a child?
Stories were really important to me from the very beginning. I had a grandfather who wrote stories before I could even read, and he put pictures with them, so they were, you know, sort of animated stories for a pre-reader.
Uh-huh.
And to me, this was magical. So stories, yes, have been important from the very beginning for me.
Well, is it inevitable then that you became a writer yourself?
Probably not. But interestingly, in my case, I always wanted to write. I can't remember a time when I didn't want to write. And that same grandfather sent me a diary as soon as I could print. So uh-huh. I've got this little diary. I was not an early reader or writer. but I've got this little diary that I started when I was 6 years old and was very keen on it.
It's fun how to think back at these things when we were a kid. Even if we don't really know what we're doing,
right.
we enjoy it, you know what I mean? Or we like doing it, and you know, it makes sense, I guess, at the end of the day, doesn't it?
Well, it's true, and, you know, the things that you do when you're a child, it's for pleasure.
Yeah.
I can remember, like, hours of reading and writing and playing with words and that sort of thing, and it was all pleasure. It had nothing to do with any end point.
Is writing still pleasure for you?
Yes. Yes, and more than pleasure, it's my meaning.
Mm.
It's how I think about things. It's how I encounter the world. It's just about everything to me.
I don't know how to put this. It comes through as I'm reading the book because I'm enjoying it, obviously, as a reader. But mm-hmm. but one can tell that as a writer, I mean, it is work, obviously. But I can see how putting words together might seem enjoyable for someone like you.
Yeah. I mean, my when I'm writing, what I'm trying to do is not only tell the story, which is immensely important, especially in a book like this, but to find the most beautiful way to tell it. I really do enjoy the pleasure of words and putting them together and being in the tradition of telling stories.
So, to your book, Speak Silence, is that how you pronounce her name, Gota?
Gota, yes.
So we meet her at the beginning of the book, and she's talking about her experience with the war, having, say, watched it on television, largely. And then she goes to Sarajevo to see Cosmos, who we find out later that she has a past history with. We'll talk about that in just a sec. But what did... go to know about Sarajevo other than, say, watching it on television? Had she been there before, say?
No, no. So her experience could mirror the experience of a Canadian in the 1990s who might have watched the Siege of Sarajevo on television. And, you know, a lot of Canadians at that point had also watched the Olympics in Sarajevo. And people were very enchanted by the Sarajevo Olympics because the city is so beautiful. And there was a beautiful bobsled track that was, you know, visible from almost any part of the city. So Gota would have known the city in that way. But watching that war on television or that siege on television was extraordinary for Canadians because it went on for a long time. And we got introduced and guided through that war by a lot of women reporters, interestingly, through the CBC. You know, the young Carol Off, the young Anna Maria Tremonti. And then when the courts started, something short of a decade later, one of the chief prosecutors was our Canadian judge, Louise Arbour.
Right, yeah.
So we had, in Canada, we had a decade or more of a kind of consciousness of this war that was at a remove, but nevertheless was in our living rooms every night if we watched.
Yeah, even as I was reading the book, I found a lot of it familiar because I ended up working with, you know, my first job, say, out of high school, working with people who were from that part of the world.
Oh, is that right? Can you tell me about that? That's fascinating.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, you know, I was like, you know, in my early 20s, you know, the people say, oh, yeah, that guy, you know, they'd whisper behind his back, you know, that guy, you know, he's had some military experience, or that guy was, you know, and then another person later on had at a different place I guess his family were refugees because of the war, and it was just fascinating to how people would react to someone who had come from far away, who had experienced, you know, conflict, and who was essentially getting away from their past, trying to make a life for themselves. And, you know, as a kid, you know, I was 20, but, you know, I still think of myself as a kid. You would wonder what to ask or even what to joke about.
This is so true. You know? I mean, you're so right about that. And I think that as because Canada has a very international population, and I think as we move along in our own history, we are starting to understand more that it's really important to ask questions, but also to listen, to really try to hear people's stories. But you're so right about that. Can I tell you a little anecdote from
please
the book?
Please do. Yeah, please.
Yeah, so, you know, it was very interesting to me because I did meet, of course, lots of people from the region and people who worked in the courts and so on. But there's a whole component of chess playing in this book. Two of the main characters play chess together throughout the book. And I have only a rudimentary knowledge of the game, so I thought I'd better find a chess expert to guide me through, and especially to help me compose the games for the book. And I just opened my, you know, sort of local directory for, you know, a chess player sort of closest to my house, and it was someone I recognized the name as Bosnian. So I phoned him up and I said, you know, would you teach me some chess and would you help me design some games? And this is the reason I'm writing a novel about that. And he said yes. And when I first met him, then I asked him what his own connection to the region was, and he had indeed escaped the Siege of Sarajevo. So there were a lot of synchronicities with this book. You know how it happens when you start to meet people who are connected to things that you're working on.
It's fascinating you bring up chess, because I worked in an office once where they found a chessboard somewhere. And they put it up, on the top of a filing cabinet or something like that, or a table. And a couple of the guys decided to start playing. And I was going to ask you later in the interview about, because I'm 39 and I don't know how to play chess, and I'm wondering if it's too late. But
never too late.
Really? Yeah.
No, of course not.
And so there were guys who would play one another, and then everyone else would walk by the chessboard and look at it, you know, as if it was curious or fascinating or exotic even. And you know, I'd walk by as well, and you know, we'd chat, I guess, about the weather. And then they would ask if I played, and I said no. And people that you wouldn't think would know how to play chess would be talking to me about certain moves. Oh, that he didn't do that right. See this here, and that, you know, to me it was, you know, speaking another language, really.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating how this game, as it you know, plays out in the book, literally. Is a source of connection for a lot of the people, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very popular game in the former Yugoslavia. Mm. And one of the interesting things about it there was that there were lots of school clubs before the war, before the 1990s war. And, you know, but they were segregated. They were boys' chess clubs and girls' chess clubs, which, unlike sports, there's no real reason to separate them.
Yeah.
And so the girls began to lobby during that time to play together with the boys. But it, also in Sarajevo, they have outdoor chess places, and there's one where the chess pieces are almost life size.
Oh yeah,
they'd be 4 foot or 5 foot, no, 4 foot chess pieces.
Yeah.
And in a square, and people, you know, so you're the two players are literally moving pieces that are almost the size of them around this enormous board, and there will be the whole groups of people standing around the edges sort of shouting advice or scoffing at people for bad moves. It's a very communal game.
Back to your book for just a second. Well, I guess this is all part of the book. So the relationship between Gota and Cosmos, she hasn't seen him in 11 years. They met in Paris, and they have a child. Is that right?
That's correct.
She hasn't seen him in 11 years. What's the, other than the child, obviously, has there been contact, a connection even?
Well, they both meet in Paris when they're very young. He has left Sarajevo sort of in a kind of sadness because the woman that he loves is married mm-hmm. to someone else. And she has left her home in Canada also in a little bit of sadness. Her father has died, and they both are out in the world looking for experience in the world and adventure and love. So they meet each other in Paris. They have a wonderful relationship, but Cosmos is really not looking for anything longer term, and he wants more experience in theater and so on, so he leaves. And at that point, Gota is pregnant. This is not a planned pregnancy, mm-hmm. and she heads back to Canada because she does not want to have a baby and raise it alone as a foreigner in Paris.
And so, when they meet again 11 years later, he's with Edina in a restaurant, and Gota is drawn to her eventually.
Yes, they connect almost instantly. So Cosmos is with Edina, but he's not with her romantically.
Right.
They're friends.
Yeah.
She's lost her husband, and she is not interested in a relationship with him. He's not particularly interested in a relationship with Gota. And so you've got three characters, each loving the wrong person. You know,
yeah.
They're very loving characters, but they're not loving. Each of them is sort of looking at the wrong person. It's sort of like Shakespeare's comedies where the lovers are in the woods chasing each other, each one in love with someone else. But the two women are drawn together, and there's a kind of community of feeling and silence between them. They recognize things between them, things about women who love and about motherhood and about their sexuality, that they, it's a kind of relationship of feeling and empathy before they actually know each other very well. And I think that this happens, you know, more often than it happens often that we have these relationships that are based on feelings about each other before we actually express them in words. And I was kind of interested in that, how we do connect through feelings, and it's only later that we tell each other our stories.
Yeah, it's funny when you go back to, not funny, but I guess it's interesting, when you go back to looking at certain aspects. I went to go reread parts of it the other day, or yesterday, last night, and you're putting pieces together, and then it makes sense, you know, like, oh, yeah, that's why this happens, if you will.
Yeah,
What is Edina's work?
So Edina is, she comes from Visegrad, and she comes from Foča, and she survived the war, and she survived one of the rape camps, and she lost her husband during the war. Her mother and her daughter both were resettled in Vienna. There were many, many women who were displaced in that war because their homes were destroyed and they couldn't go back to their long homelands. And many did not want to go back because perpetrators were still living in their villages. So Edina has founded an NGO called Women Victims of War that its purpose is to record the stories of women in the war with a purpose of creating testimony for future legal work. But she also, through all of these files, she has an office with walls of files of testimony of women. She is able to collaborate with the international court in order to provide them the kinds of evidence that they need to build their case.
And so a lot of these testimonies are which is, you know, obviously discussed in your book. A lot of it is difficult to hear about or read. That also speaks to why some victims don't speak out. Do you understand why?
What I have been told is that when each time a woman survivor retells the story, there's an element of reliving the story, and some people use the word re-traumatizing.
Yeah, re-victimize, yeah.
And re-victimizing, yes. And so it takes a very, very special woman who is willing to do that and who has this kind of inner purpose and courage to put her story on the record. Because in my fictionalized version and in the real court version, the women who came are a very small number of the thousands and thousands whose stories are either on the record in the former Yugoslavia or have not been recorded. So the women who testified are we have to do nothing but admire them because they put everything on the line to tell their stories, to get them on the record.
Yeah, and obviously the courage to face their abusers as well, right?
That's absolutely right, yeah. And from our perspective, if we bring it back to North America or to us here in Canada, thank you for discussing this book with me, because not everyone wants to meditate on this kind of material, to acknowledge that this kind of crime has taken place and continues to take place in the world. And I think that you have accepted this challenge to do it is wonderful. And the less that we are afraid of the material, the less shameful it becomes. So much of this has been repressed for the last, 2,000 years since the Iliad, because people are simply ashamed of it as a war crime.
What do you think it is, Kim, that someone gains, say, from understanding someone else's suffering? And I say that even though, for me at least, this is not in close proximity to where I am.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe if we ask ourselves, who are we if we don't strive to have empathy with the stories of others? I mean, whether this is halfway across the world or whether it's in, you know, our own neighborhood, one of our human capacities is to be able to empathize with others and to hear other people's stories. I think it's essential to being a human being. And one of the things that I've been really interested in is, you know, now in a world of the kind of connectedness that we have with the internet and so on, what do we do once we know?
Mm.
And we do know, we can know. I mean, these, for example, I mean, there's so much to know and there's so much to hold, but in the case of these courts, all the court records for these trials is online. It's available to anybody to see. So that, you know, once we see and know, then what is our responsibility for that?
Yeah, that's something that I've been thinking about is what do we do once we know?
The core question.
Yeah, I'm going to finish your book, obviously, but I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, there's more to read. There's more to know about, isn't there?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, I this is just a little story. With some previous work I was doing, I was doing some talks with Marina Nemeth, who's written a book called Prisoner of Tehran.
Yeah.
And sometimes for audience members, so she's a torture survivor.
Right.
And a great human rights advocate. And sometimes in the audience, when we were speaking, people would say to her, "What do I do now that I know?" She was so articulate about this because she said two things. She said, "It's not enough to just know.
Yeah.
That's your first step." But she said, "The next thing you do is look for how you can reach out to another." And she was really simple. I remember telling one young man in an audience, "Have you shoveled your neighbor's walk? You know, what can you do very locally to demonstrate your caring and your desire to know their story and to know them?" Mm. And I find this very comforting because, you know, if I can work locally, that opens me to working in other ways as well. And it also means that if we could all be kind and we could all ask to know each other's stories, that would be a marvelous starting point.
Yeah, indeed. Kim, in terms of your experience of writing this book, I understand you'd gone to Sarajevo, is that right?
Yes.
How long ago was that?
Oh, let me think, probably about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I went, the travel was really, really interesting. I went with, I traveled with a former soldier who had fought in the war. And a UN case manager came and traveled with me as well. So he had, you know, a full iPod or device full of the stats that as we were traveling through the region. So we knew how many people were buried where and all the kinds of stats that they use, you know, in order to build cases at the courts. And this former soldier, of course, had lived experience. So it was a very, very interesting trip. We were able to go back to the crime sites. We visited, you know, I visited alone the women's centers. I really got a very strong feeling for the region in that trip. And it was interesting because it was both sort of intellectual with all the stats and numbers, mm-hmm. but also very lived. I mean, the soldier took us to the bunkers that he had, you know, shot from to defend Sarajevo. And the interesting thing was he has a great commitment to teaching the war to foreigners.
Yeah.
He had also driven for the UN when they were doing a lot of their research. And the very first thing he did in any tour, if you like, where he was driving people to different crime sites was to stop at a graveyard, and it was his brother's grave that he stopped at. He didn't tell us this. I was leaving on our very first morning traveling together with him, and we drove up the mountain and stopped at the graveyard. And I said, "Oh, you know, this is, why are we here?" He said, "That's my brother's grave. He died on the second day of the war." And so you could feel this kind of deep connectedness that he had to both his own experience, but also to teaching us what it really means.
Did you know then while you were on the trip that you were going to write a book like this?
I was still researching. I had hoped to. I mean, I knew about the trials. I wanted to. I didn't know if I was capable of it. And so at that point, I was still researching, trying to listen to the stories.
Yeah. I mean, it's I read an essay that's been published, I guess, in anticipation of the release of the book, about your own experience there and this trip that you took. What is gunpowder in vodka? What does it taste like?
That is so funny. It's a little, I guess it's a little bit bitter. I don't know that this taste is actually very strong. That was a curious moment.
And it's found its way in the book too, as well. Is that right?
Yes.
This is is this your fifth book, I understand?
Yes.
This book is coming out to a different world than your previous books. This is obviously of a different time and place than your previous books as well. But I can't help, as I was reading the book, think about how appropriate's not the right word, but how, I guess, it makes sense to read something like this in our sort of COVID reality. I mean, as we go through life nowadays, a lot of what you've just said, especially about what to do once we have certain information, what to do with it, I think it would serve us well in this time, don't you think?
I'm absolutely delighted that you feel that way. I mean, so this book was finished before COVID hit. Uh-huh. But, you know, one of the things that we've all learned through COVID is that our world is truly interconnected. You know, if there's COVID in one part of the world, the rest of the world is at risk. And we're learning that in a really profound way. If we can extend that consciousness to our own histories and wars and interconnections interpersonally, that kind of sense of the world is also reflected in the international courts. I mean, they're developed with the aspiration of creating a law that the whole world can agree to. So, I mean, it's still an aspiration. It's still quite idealized, but I think it's extraordinary. And I found it really inspirational. It was one of the reasons I wanted to write this book, that we have, you know, imagined that. If you have the two sides of it, you know, you have illness that's international, or, you know, communicable disease that's international, yeah, and then you also have a quest for justice that's international, then we start working together in a way that's really unprecedented in human history.
That, you know, I just remembered something from the start of the book. You introduced us to a couple of characters at the very beginning, Carla, and the judge from Zambia, whose name I forgot.
Gladys, yep.
Yeah, and as you're talking about them and telling us about them, introducing them, us to them, just how excited they are, looking forward they are to this new international court. I mean, it's unlike anything they've seen heretofore. And as a reader, I'm realizing, you know, it's sort of been with us for a while now, 20 years plus, but it's still very new, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, historically, it's very new, but it's incredibly exciting. I mean, we have people from all over the world working at that court, and, you know, they've had to write a law every country has their own rules rules of procedures. They've had to rewrite an ability to work internationally. The judges represent, you know, most of the countries in the world that are signatories to the UN. So, yeah, no, it's incredibly exciting. And you know, I did spend some time in The Hague, and I was fascinated by the people I met there, because they're so dedicated to ideas of justice and to the excitement of working together. And they have to be immensely flexible to work, you know, across all these different languages and cultures. It's a very, very exciting place to be.
Speaking about that, because when you talk about Carla from Hamburg, at the beginning of the book, you write, "A woman has no country and wants no country. Borders shift and crack into something different." What is this something different that they want or get? I mean, I guess that's what makes them ideal for a court like this, isn't it?
Yes, yes, and that's really interesting that you picked up that line, because "a woman has no country and wants no country" is actually an allusion to Virginia Woolf, who wrote that in her book Three Guineas, which was her anti-war essay. And she says that because women have been marginalized, why would they want to engage in war? Because they don't even belong to their own countries. And so this is a kind of idealized idea, notion of, you know, if we don't belong to our own countries because we've been marginalized, which was truer in Virginia Woolf's day than it is in mine in Canada, but still true, especially for certain communities, then, you know, why not turn to belonging to an international community? And so then if you, you know, if you have an international community, the notion of borders starts to change.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to just draw this to a contemporary sort of, I guess, example. The same people that are against, say, international courts or anti-globalist, as they call themselves, are the same people who are against vaccines or who supported Trump. So it puts it all into perspective for a lot of us if we want to understand this stuff, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a certain consciousness to want to be connected at the same time to your own community and to the world. It's not to say that you shouldn't be in your own community, but to want to do both. Yeah. That takes a big consciousness.
Yeah. I could talk all day with you. but I'll let you go because I want to get back to reading your book. I'm enjoying it a great deal. Well, enjoying it is, I don't know if that's the right word, because a lot of it can be unpleasant, but it's so beautifully written that it just, one marvels at your ability to put, you know, write and put words together. Congratulations on this book, and I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Oh, thank you. It was a wonderful conversation. It really was.
The book is called Speak Silence. It is published by Penguin. Its author, Kim Eklund, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.